very much. I have the pleasure of introducing our last panel of the day. My name is Leland Frost, and I'm a 3L at Vanderbilt and an articles editor on LPAR. I'd like to introduce this last panel, and the piece is The Military Environmental Complex by Sarah E. Light. Sarah Light is an assistant professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. She teaches environmental management, law and policy, and negotiation. She previously served for 10 years as an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of New York and for 4 years as the chief of the office's Environmental Protection Unit. Professor Light earned her JD from Yale Law School, a master's in philosophy and politics from Oxford University, where she was a Rhodes Scholar, and she graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College. Next are commenters. The Honorable Sharon Burke is a senior advisor to the International Security Program at New America, where she focuses on international security and the security implications of energy, climate change, and other natural resources challenges. Ms. Burke previously served in the Obama administration as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy. She has also held a number of senior U.S. government positions, including at the Department of State. She attended Williams College and Columbia University, where she was a Zuckerman and International Fellow at the School of International and Public Affairs. Next is Mr. John Dukes. He is the Executive Director of Public Sector Business Development for Constellation. He develops, executes large-scale energy efficiency and generation projects for the Department of Defense and federal civilian government agencies. Prior to Constellation, he worked at Pepco Energy Services for 12 years. Mr. Dukes is a certified energy manager and is a member of the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America, the Association of Energy Engineers, and the Association of Climate Change Officers. And then finally, Amanda Simpson is the executive director of the U.S. Army Office of Energy Initiatives, leading the Army's efforts to implement large-scale renewable energy projects. She was previously the special assistant to the Army Acquisition Executive. Ms. Simpson earned a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Harvey Mudd College, a Master's of Science in Engineering for California State University, and a Master in Business Administration from the University of Alabama. Arizona, sorry, I'm from Alabama. Yes. She is also an Associate Fellow of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, where she served on the Systems Engineering Technical Committee. Thank you all very much.
Good afternoon. First, thanks so much to ELI and to Vanderbilt Law School and to all of the student editors for inviting me to participate today. I'm very honored to be here. So my article, The Military Environmental Complex, identifies a phenomenon, and it's a phenomenon that I want to argue is worthy of further attention and research. What I call the Military Environmental Complex is the U.S. Defense Department's extensive undertaking to reduce its use of fossil fuels and to increase its use of renewable energy sources. It refers to the web of interaction that's currently going on between the Department of Defense, Congress, the President, and the private sector. And I want to argue that it's potentially an important tool in the fight to combat climate change. And it's one that has been underappreciated in at least the legal scholarship to date. I also think that some caution is warranted in light of historical experience to make sure that we prevent rent-seeking in the military environmental complex. And so what I want to do today is to talk a little bit about what it is that's motivating the different institutional actors to participate in this phenomenon, and then to close by making some recommendations as to, in order to ensure that it serves as a force for good and to avoid the potential for rent-seeking. So as I was getting my lunch on the break, someone came over to me with the draft of my article, pointed to the title, and said, "Military Environmental Complex, that's a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it?" And what I want to suggest is that there are really two competing narratives about the military and its relationship to the environment. On the one hand, when you think of the U.S. military, you think rapacious consumer of energy. You may not think of the environment's best friend. Legal rules protecting the environment largely have exemptions when the national security interest of the United States is at issue. It has the single largest energy footprint in the nation. And so that all seems to provide some evidence that the military is in conflict with the goals of environmental protection. So that's reinforced forced by the idea of the military-industrial complex, right? A negative image comes to mind when you utter those words, the idea of inappropriate entanglement of private industry with decisions about whether to go to war, calling armaments manufacturers the merchants of death, and the revolving door of influence between private industry and government. But I want to suggest that there's another narrative and that there's another story to tell here. So at its height, in the 20th century, the military-industrial complex, and that being the web of interaction between the military, other institutions of government, and the private sector, actually stimulated technological innovation that led to important spillover technologies that have had tremendous importance for us in the private, the civilian world. So to give an example, I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Just a few short blocks from my office, there was a Defense Department contract build the ENIAC computer, the first computer, which was originally built for the purpose of calculating ballistics trajectories in World War II. And subsequent to the creation of this very important product for military use, the creators of the ENIAC went on to found the UNIVAC, to build the UNIVAC computer, right? And that, similarly, the internet comes from DARPANET, right? The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency system for internal communications. We can also think about semiconductors and the global positioning system. So what I want to suggest is that there is potentially a more positive story to tell about the development of technology when military demand is at issue. So right now, the military is engaged in an extensive undertaking to reduce its fossil fuel use and to increase its use of renewable energy and renewable technology. The military is doing this in response to a number of drivers. So the first is its own internal demand. The second is in response to Congress. The third is in response to the president. And finally, there is tremendous interaction with the private sector. So I want to talk about each of these. So first, the Department of Defense itself. What is it that is internally motivating the Defense Department in this regard? It serves in many roles. The Defense Department is a warfighter, but it's also a manager of land. It is the nation's single largest landlord. It's often a first user of pre-commercial technologies, technologies that are not available to the rest of us, and it's a potential high demand, concentrated consumer. So why is this important? This is important for a whole host of reasons, but largely because when there's specific demand pull, when there's a specific demand for a specific purpose, that may be a much more influential reason to create a new technology or a new process or to change behavior than simply the abstract goal of protecting the environment. So while this paper focuses on the importance of technological development, particularly in the energy sector, the same could be said of the need to conserve water. The same could also be said of the importance of engaging in a values debate and the potential for the military to serve as a trusted source for those who might not otherwise support clean energy and conservation, but who trust the military as an important institution in society. So with respect to the military as driver, so there's I want to argue that there's kind of an exceptional alignment between the military's mission to protect national security and the importance of energy sustainability. The military's total energy costs tend to be on the order of $19 billion . Three-quarters of that is for operational energy, meaning energy related to its combat mission. One-quarter is necessary for powering its fixed installations and facilities. It manages approximately 2.3 billion square feet of building space. Its physical footprint, for comparison, is three times the size of Walmart's. It manages 28 million acres of land in the United States. And in particular, in its role as a warfighter in recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military has become, has obviously always been very aware of the importance of fuel supplies. But in this, in these recent conflicts, this has become perhaps even more important. Thousands of people were killed guarding fuel and water convoys in recent conflicts. And so any reduction in the amount of fuel that needs to be brought into the theater of war can potentially directly reduce the number of lives lost. At bottom, that's a very important driver for the military. Here, the Department of Defense is acting as an unequivocal validator of climate science. So so in its most recent quadrennial defense reports for 2014, but originally in 2010, the military has referred to climate change as a threat multiplier, and energy efficiency or reduction in demand as a force multiplier. So what does that mean? What does it mean that climate change is a threat multiplier? Well, we have new shipping lanes opening in the Arctic due to loss of ice, which the Russian Navy wants to patrol. Obviously, if there are droughts leading to climate refugees, the United States military may be called upon to police those conflicts. So there's a sense in which climate change can increase the risk of instability and conflict. What does it mean for energy efficiency to be a force multiplier? The idea is that the United States can perform its military mission going farther, faster, with a more quieter profile. Soldiers can carry fewer batteries. If you can replace a diesel-powered generator in the field with renewable energy solar blankets, soldiers can carry fewer batteries and do not need to turn on noisy generators that can potentially reveal their positions to the other side. So again, it's a very concrete demand for these technologies. So I've mentioned the role of the Department of Defense as a self-driver, but I want to briefly touch on the other institutions, Congress first, then the President, and then I want to talk briefly about the relationship with the private sector. So Congress, while perhaps unable or unwilling to enact sweeping climate change legislation in the United States that binds the private sector, has actually been very active in setting goals for the Defense Department. One important goal being that the Department of Defense need to produce or procure not less than 25% of the total quantity of facility energy they consumes by 2025 from renewable energy sources. So that's a sort of a quasi-renewable portfolio standard for the federal government. In addition, Congress has authorized the Defense Department to enter into certain kinds of unique financial arrangements, the most important of which, I would argue, is a 30-year term for power purchase agreements, which the Department of Defense is unique in its ability to enter into these kind of 30-year contracts to purchase renewable energy. Other agencies are limited to a 10-year term. I had a speaker from a private firm come to my class this past week and lament the fact that his company was not allowed to enter into even a 20-year power purchase agreement. So a 30-year power purchase agreement is actually a very important tool. In addition to Congress driving the military environmental complex, the President has also played an important role. At the end of March, last month, just a few weeks ago, the President issued an executive order, Executive Order 13693, for those of you who wish to look it up afterward, which directed federal agencies to cut their emissions by approximately 40% against a 2008 baseline. And there's a specific section in this executive order, Section 15, which specifically talks about the importance of supply chain management to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So what this says is that the White House Council on Environmental Quality is directed to publish a list of major federal suppliers of all agencies. This is not specific to the Defense Department, and creates a scorecard. So the scorecard says, does this supplier disclose its Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions? And second, has this supplier set targets for reducing its greenhouse gas emissions? And this is a way, through the use of an executive order and through the procurement power, to have an influence on the private sector, which is technically outside the scope of executive authority. So if you go to the scorecard, which is on the CEQ website, and again, this applies to all federal agencies, you might be interested to know that the top five suppliers to the United States government by dollar figure for last year were Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. These are all major defense contractors, right? So this presidential action is having a tremendous impact on the defense community. And in fact, if you go to Lockheed Martin, Lockheed's the number one government contractor by dollar figure, its most recent corporate sustainability statement in its annual report said the following. With 85% of Lockheed Martin's business coming from the U.S. government, approximately 60% with the Department of Defense alone, It is imperative that we recognize the sustainability goals of our customers and align our business practices to assist in achieving their mission. So what I want to suggest about the military environmental complex is that this procurement aspect is actually having an impact on the private sector. Right? The relationship between the Department of Defense and the private sector is very important. So I want to just very briefly talk about a couple of programs. So I've mentioned the kind of civilian spin-offs, the computers and GPS. There is actually a sense in which the technology is going both ways. So it is not purely spin-off. What another scholar has called spin-on is equally important. So, for example, the U.S. Marine Corps has a program. It used to be called the Expeditionary Forward Operating Base Program, and it is now called something else, the E2C program. And what the Marine Corps did was they worked with a private developer on a developing solar blanket. The goal was to reduce the number of batteries that soldiers have to carry and allow us to reduce the amount of fuel that we need to bring in to power our diesel generators. So they worked with a private firm. The private firm had developed this solar blanket, but it was somewhat rigid. It wasn't, as the director of the program explained to me, Marines proof. And so what they did was they basically had the Marines come in and, you know, stomp on the blanket and see if are we going to break the solar panels or not, and talk about what the military specific needs were. And that has led to the creation of a new technology. And this new technology, created by the private sector with input from the military, is possibly going to be available to all of you when you go on your backpacking trips, or if there is a superstorm on the East Coast that turns off your electricity, this may be something that you will end up using. Another example is a program that Ms. Simpson is the director of, and I had the pleasure of interviewing her, her predecessor in that role in connection with this article, is that the military is now using these 30-year power purchase agreements to have private developers come in on military land, build solar arrays to power installations. The Department of Defense only agrees to purchase the electricity, but it doesn't own the equipment, it doesn't build the equipment, and none of that is taxpayer financed. So what's happening is the private sector is using existing solar technology, but there's concentrated demand for it in the military. And that, of course, has the potential to drive down the costs for the rest of us in the civilian universe when ultimately we end up wanting to install more solar power. So what do we make of all of this? And I'm coming to my conclusion. So I suggest that there is potential for rent seeking here. And I just want to point out one example. So it's important to recognize that when there is government funding involved. I worked for the government for 10 years, and I used to do QTAM actions under the False Claims Act on behalf of the government. There's always the potential for waste, fraud, and abuse. And that is no different here. Even if the end is one that I like, of increasing solar technology, that's always an issue. So, for example, if you look at the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the military budget for each year, you might see some odd provisions. So, for example, there's a mandate from the 2009 military budget saying that the Department of Defense needs to conduct a study on various alternative fuels, one of which is coal-to-liquid fuel. Interesting. Ironically, in 2008, the Defense Science Board, which is an advisory entity that advises the Department of Defense, recommended against the use of coal-to-liquid fuels as being incompatible with Department of Defense needs. So, it's important, and this is why I suggest that a research agenda needs to focus on this more, to figure out who are the entities who are providing these services, what kinds of contacts are there between the military and the private sector, is this ordinary government contracting, or are there concerns about waste, fraud, and abuse? So my recommendations are as follows. Basically, I make four recommendations. The first is that this important 30-year power purchase agreement authority that is unique to the Defense Department, I would suggest that that be extended to other agencies, most importantly the GSA, which purchases power on behalf of most other federal agencies. This has been, according to people that I have spoken with, and my understanding, very important in the Department of Defense's undertaking these major development of renewable energy generation facilities on military lands. The second is that it's important to for Congress to make clear to the Defense Department that these are goals that will persist into the future. So, for example, I mentioned the 25 by 25, the 25% renewables by 2025. If it is possible to make that goal go further into the future or to increase that goal, I think that that would be a positive for the environment. Third, it's important to promote diffusion and openness if we are both to be sure that there is no waste, fraud, and abuse, but also so that the technology is not closely held by the military, but instead actually comes to civilian use. And I would argue that universities have an important role to play here in bringing together people from the Defense Department with the private sector, as well as researchers. So in order to take my own advice, I've actually organized a panel at the Wharton School of Business on Earth Day in which we will have the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and the Environment, as well as the colonel from the U.S. Marine Corps, whose solar blankets I mentioned, come to speak to an audience of primarily people from the business community about what is going on in this interrelationship. So I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to hearing the comments.
I have a couple of slides, so I'm just going to stand here so I can see them. You'll have to forgive me for these slides. They're a little, they're just photographs. They're not PowerPoint. I don't work at the Department of Defense anymore, so I don't have to do that kind of PowerPoint. But I just wanted to make a couple of general overall points, and Sarah's done a terrific job with her article of laying out a comprehensive case, and I think a lot of what she's put in here is not well known, and one of the really important things that she lays out is that the Department of Defense behaves the way it does, that part of this is an infrastructure of laws and regulations and executive orders, that it's not just people randomly deciding to do things, not that that never happens. See, I'm not there anymore, so I can say these things. But there's reasons why military organizations act the way they do in this field. And there are targets that they must comply with. So it was great to have that all laid out end to end. And I really think Sarah did an important service for us in writing such a piece. So I have some general comments, though, because I have a different perspective or a different spin. I don't disagree with anything Sarah said, but I have a couple little things, like the Army actually developed the solar blankets. The Marine Corps will take credit to that, until the sun sets. That's all right. There's this inter-service rivalry, but it's a healthy thing for the most part. But a different spin on this information. The Department of Defense, if you look at it this way, as a very big business, and in so many ways, that's really what it is a very big business. Think about it. It's, more than 2 million employees. It's worldwide in almost every country in the world, although the numbers vary. And the budget is $500, $600 billion. All depends on how you count and how many supplementals there are in a year. So I think fiscal year 15 finally penciled out at about $554 billion, but that probably isn't a settled number at this point. That's a massive enterprise. And so it does have a big shadow, a big influence, and how it acts matters. So in some ways, it's like any other business. It has overhead and costs it seeks to manage. It has personnel issues that it has to manage. In some ways, it acts like a business, but in other ways, it's not like any other business. And that's where I wanted to say a few opening points with my world tour here. That's Antietam today, okay? Now it is a national park, so it has been preserved as a battlefield. That's Antietam at the time of the battle in the Civil War. This is Verdun, which was the site of a battle in World War I. That's what it looked like in World War I in 1916. Anybody know what that is? It's Hiroshima. That's Ho Chi Minh City. That is a Syrian refugee camp today, so I don't have a after picture for you. That is the DMZ in Korea today, so who knows when we'll have an after picture for that. And this is Afghanistan. It's kind of hard to find battle photos of Afghanistan that where you can attribute the way it looks to war. If anybody's been there, there are parts of Afghanistan that look like the surface of the moon to begin with. But war is tough on every place. And that's the core point that I wanted to make here, which is war is not environmentally friendly, period. That is the core mission of the Department of Defense, is war fighting. It is the core responsibility, legally, everything else, is to fight wars. There's lots of other parts of that mission that go along with that. A core mission for the department is also to prevent war. It is also to deter war. It is also to deal with humanitarian and disaster relief missions. Those are also core missions for the Department of Defense. But the heart of it is to make war. And war is not environmentally friendly ever. War consumes and war destroys. It takes a lot of resources to have one, and it destroys everything in its path. Those pictures are bleak, but you know, one thing that's at least a good message in that too is that places do recover. It's not easy, but it happens. And in a lot of the places where the battles are, we preserve the memory for a variety of reasons. So that's kind of a missing piece of Sarah's article, is that don't ever fool yourself that while you can be really positive about the wonderful things that Amanda Simpson is doing, and I'm so glad she's here to tell you, because it's proof that the way someone operates can make a difference. But don't ever let yourself forget what the core mission of the Department of Defense is. And that is why most of the activities that consume energy and environmental resources are exempted from domestic environmental laws. It's not because the military is exceptional in that sense. It's because war is exceptional. It is a practical acknowledgement that this is the nature of war. So you wouldn't want to put those kinds of laws on war. That flies in the face of what it is. Now, to be fair, and I do have a comment written on this. It is a draft, so I do have to warn you of that. It's not a final draft. And also, since we are dealing with a room full of lawyers, I should clarify that I do not have copyright permission for these pictures. Precisely. And I can help you with the sourcing if you want to reuse any of them. But what Sarah is really talking about is the business of war, right? This is about how you resource war. And DOD is not exempt from domestic laws in that. And by the way, DOD is also not exempt from environmental laws of war. There are environmental laws that are in the Geneva Convention. There are additional conventions, which I know Phil Sherman, who's a lawyer in the Department of Defense, knows all this stuff. But I did not know until I was looking this up to respond to Sarah that there was a convention on weather modification that we have ratified because we did do weather modification in Vietnam. So there are laws of war that apply to the environment. However, the domestic laws that Sarah's talking about do not apply to any of the department's core warfighting missions. So where it does apply is to how you run your bases in the United States. The one thing I really wanted to take issue with is just Sarah's use of the term environmental complex, because I don't believe that is a fair description of what exists right now. If you look back to the way that President Eisenhower used the term, he said it represented unwarranted influence in politics, the economy, and even the very structure of our society. That's what he was afraid of at his farewell speech. He said it would result from the confluence of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry. And, you know, it was certainly a valid concern. It remains a problem today. Military spending was about 10% of GDP when he was president. It's about 3.8% now, but we have a bigger economy. So it's a lot of money. It does cast a shadow on our economy. It casts a shadow on the department itself. There are weapons systems the department can't cancel because they have political constituency that won't allow it to happen. So, you know, Eisenhower's warning is still something that's fair to say. And certainly when you work in the Department of Defense, and this is the part I really loved writing in my article that I could never say when I'm in, but there is like this ring of Saturn around the building of contractors and consultants who are looking for a way to make money. But that's a very transactional relationship. It's not so much a rent-seeking behavior in the true sense, at least as an energy person, when I think of rent-seeking, I'm thinking of oil rents. It's transactional, right? DOD is a customer. We talk about partnership all the time, and partnership is important in developing things together. But at the end of the day, they're selling the department things, and the department is buying. It's a very transactional relationship. And most of those companies play an extremely valuable role in building the national defense. There are always going to be some who don't, and we saw a lot of bad behavior in Afghanistan and Iraq, like you do in any war, with vendors going straight into the war zone and selling things directly to fielded forces that they may or may not need, that may or may not be ready for them. That happens. But by and large, most of that transactional relationship is necessary for us to build a national defense. And as Sarah notes, there's a spin-off and a spin-on in innovation that's really important. But a caveat here to throw out as well, it's not guaranteed. So you all know what the internet is. And it's had an outsized influence on global commerce, and it did start as a military technology. But stealth technology hasn't really crossed over into the civilian world. DoD innovates for its own purposes, or rather it asks for innovation from the private sector. It pulls innovation in for its own purposes, and there's no guarantee that it's going to cross over. So I think there are some opportunities in the energy sphere, but that is not a guarantee. So where it gets interesting is DoD's direct spending on environmental goods and services is fairly modest, which is one of the reasons why I don't really see it as a military environmental complex. It's not a big amount of money, not as a percent of the DoD budget, not as a percent of environmental goods and services commerce nationally. And it also, and again, my colleagues can't say this, but it is one of the first things that goes when the budget gets tight, as is true for any company, right? You're looking for the things when you have to tighten the belt that you can tighten. But there's other kinds of spending that I think are potentially even more consequential and interesting, and it's the indirect spending. So you can look at what does the Department of Defense do to improve the energy performance of its base that's specifically all about energy. That's one kind of expense, it's a good one. But the military construction budget overall is much bigger than that, than the specific thing that's flagged for energy. So if you're setting codes, so for example, DoD has incorporated climate change into its building codes. That means that won't count as a direct dollar towards an environmental good or service, but it can have an outsized effect in that $8 billion military construction budget every year, or however much it ends up being, depends on the budget year. That indirect spending and the way they spend that money, particularly when it comes to acquisition, so that's like $140 billion a year, when you're buying ships, planes, trains, all kinds of equipment, if you're incorporating into it things like energy performance, the potential for a second order benefit is huge. It may not register as an environmental good. So for example, if you're asking for a ground combat vehicle to have better energy performance and it leads to some innovation in the alternator or in the engine efficiency, that's still going to be important innovation and energy innovation, but it may not read as an environmental good. So that indirect spending is important. Where I ultimately hope the department will go, and it's a much harder place to go, is there's direct and indirect, is complementary spending, which is more about how do you incorporate this way of thinking into the defense mission to the benefit of the defense mission. And again, never lose sight of what it's for. But when the department goes into a place like Afghanistan and goes in heavy with an immense amount of equipment, there's a big environmental resource, money resource, human impact on doing that. And when we go into a place like Afghanistan, where eventually we want to leave and leave a more stable situation and a safer one for us and for them, if we don't incorporate into that their own energy and environmental needs, and the fact that they don't have electricity, same with Iraq, our strategic goals aren't going to be as well served. So if we incorporate the fact that we want a smaller footprint in how we operate, and then it's easier for us to operate and get out, if we incorporate energy into our strategic thinking and about how it advances U.S. strategic interests, whether it's at the warfighting level or in terms of broader relationships with countries that are important to us, that kind of environmental and energy incorporation into the defense mission and the complementarity would really be powerful. And I think it would also be very beneficial for DoD's core missions. That, there's still, I think, a long way to go for the department because that's a lot harder. You have to incorporate that at the very foundations of how the place does business. It's a longer conversation, but I think that that's a worthy goal because it's good for everything. it's a mutually beneficial way of looking at the issue. So harder sell, but a really important one. And there's nothing in the exemptions to law that would constrain that. So thanks very much for the opportunity to comment.
I don't, if you don't mind, I'll just stay down here. I expect there were really beautiful pictures, or not so beautiful pictures. They're sad pictures. But good afternoon, and really thank you for the opportunity to speak here this afternoon. The U.S. Army Office of Energy Initiatives is the central management office for large-scale renewable energy projects leveraging third-party financing to bring energy resiliency to our Army installations. I'd like to thank Professor Light for including the efforts of the Energy Initiatives Task Force in your paper. It was the success of that task force that brought about the transition to an enduring office last year. The United States Army has long recognized that if we are to be successful in our primary national defense mission, we have an obligation to ensure that our soldiers of today and the soldier of the future have the land, water, and air resources that they need to train, a healthy environment in which to live, and the support of the local communities of the American people. Now, the paper implies that the military does not have to comply with environmental regulations, quote, when they conflict with the military's national security mission. In fact, we do have to be in compliance, as the process for a national security exclusion is so onerous that it is unlikely to be approved. So to that end, the scope of our environmental stewardship responsibilities is amazing. The Army is responsible for nearly 14 million acres of land. We care for 217 endangered species, over 83,000 archaeological sites, and over 62,000 historic buildings. We are also managing over 3,000 environmental permits, 1.3 million acres of wetlands, and currently conducting environmental cleanup at over 1,600 sites. And we do it all very well. The endangered red calcated woodpecker's habitat has been so well protected at Fort Stewart, Georgia, that the population has recovered to the point that they are now exported to other areas for reintroduction. While we have harvested over 790 acres of timber for the large solar project that will provide 90 megawatts of clean, affordable power at Fort Stewart, Gordon, and Benning, the Army will plant over 2,100 acres over the next 2 years of native longleaf pine, the habitat of the red calcated woodpecker, as part of the Army's Environmental Enhancement and Protection Program. Now, the soon-to-be-released Army Energy Security and Sustainability Strategy establishes the underlying basis for an Army that adopts security, resiliency, and future choice as an organized principle. The Army Facilities Management Regulation 420-1 is currently being revised to incorporate net zero in all its aspects, instilling these principles in everything the Army does to support its mission. The Army's energy and sustainability strategy does not end at our borders. When our current operations in Afghanistan and Iraq began, our enemies sought out our vulnerabilities, and they found and attacked our most susceptible point, our supply chain. Convoys carrying water, fuel, and supplies represented our greatest loss of life. We learned and we adapted. A forward outpost that a few years ago required replenishment of fuel and water every 4 days, through the employment of more energy-efficient equipment, incorporation of tactical solar and wind power generation, coupled with electrical storage, now only needs replenishment once every 10 days. Fuel efficiency, energy conservation, waste reduction, and water reuse are not just phases, but integrated into our requirements and designs for the modernization of equipment, tactical vehicles, and buildings, even temporary ones. Resource efficiency is necessary for the Army to minimize risk to mission objectives and reduce exposure for our soldiers. Climate change is a threat to the ability of the Army to perform its missions. affecting its installations and operations through the impacts on training and soldiers and equipment readiness. As a global phenomenon, climate change will further stress regions and individual countries. The Army's ability to accomplish our mission on a global scale depends on secure, uninterrupted access to the resources it needs, including energy, water, land, and air. In the last 10 years, we have seen a fourfold increase in power interruptions on Army installations, from increasingly severe and frequent weather events and aging weather-beaten infrastructure. The Army is actively addressing climate change by examining what effects it will have on installations and operations, and what adaptations can be made to lessen resource dependence while not reducing effectiveness. These adaptations are holistic, involving technology, behavior, doctrine, and other areas because of their interconnectedness and dependencies. Currently, exceptional opportunities exist for the military and the Army, in partnership with the private sector, to move ahead with the implementation of energy savings and renewable generation initiatives. The Army continues to support R&D and provide test beds for new renewable technologies on its installations, particularly for microgrids and storage technologies that have the potential to improve energy security. But because of sequestration and other military budget reductions, federal funding for these opportunities is highly competitive. Now, Professor Light's paper represents a good overview of the military's position and our response to increasing threats to our energy and water security and our mission to protect this nation. She discusses how the military is leveraging private financing rather than taxpayer funds to drive innovation, and that such public-private partnerships amongst the military, private financiers, and technology firms are an essential form of collaboration with the potential to perform our nation's energy profile for the better. Professor Light observes that the congressional and presidential long-term energy and environmental mandates can provide continuity across administrations and promote stability and confidence in the private markets. The Army supports energy mandates and reporting requirements as they provide direction and help measure our progress, but they must be realistic in light of current budget and development timelines. In light of the reduced government funding levels, innovative public-private risk-sharing deal structures are being used to finance energy and water conservation, demand reduction, and development of renewable generation projects. These include power purchase agreements up to 30 years in length, enhanced use leases, and energy savings performance contracts. Regulatory and policy support for development of energy projects in partnership with the private sector is essential to the effective use of these agreements. Now, the OEI is using an example of how the government can take advantage of private financing to develop large-scale renewable energy projects that it could not otherwise afford to build with appropriated funds. The OEI's mission is to protect the energy resiliency of Army installations so they can continue to conduct their critical national security missions in times of limited access to electrical power from the grid, whether caused by natural disasters or national emergencies. Due to existing financial limitations, cooperation with private industry is the most expeditious and financially prudent method to bring large-scale generation stations online. Using off-the-shelf technologies, the OEI employs long-term PPAs to build facilities to provide power to the installation, or long-term leases to private developers to build facilities on Army land to provide power for outside off-takers. We also leverage existing agreements between utilities and the Army through the GSA area-wide contract to build renewable generation facilities. Now, I'm excited to announce that the Army currently has over 20 opportunities in the development portfolio, representing over 550 megawatts of potential renewable energy generation at Army installations across the country. Two projects are operational, including the recently commissioned biomass power plant that provides 100% of the electricity at Fort Drum, New York, and the DOD's largest solar project to date at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. Two additional projects are under construction, including the solar facility at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which broke ground last week, and what will become the DOD's largest solar project at Fort Benning, Georgia, the ceremonial groundbreaking next week. The Army has led the federal government in the use of energy savings performance contracts to successfully reduce demand and improve energy efficiency. ESPCs enable energy service companies to implement energy and water saving technologies on Army bases, and the Army pays back the company for the project with the realized savings. The Army has executed over $700 million of ESPCs towards the President's Performance Contracting Challenge, representing 40% of the federal government's total. The Army Net Zero Strategy strives to bring the overall consumption of energy, water, and waste on our installations down to an effective rate of zero by using principles of integrated design to appropriately manage resources. Net zero is considered a force multiplier because reducing our energy, water, and waste demands frees up resources that can then be used to achieve Army missions. Once a pilot initiative, net zero is now policy at all permanent Army installations. The value of lessons learned and open communications with the private sector is emphasized by Professor Light. Each of the Army efforts just discussed has brought the Army and the private sector together and shown the value of sharing lessons learned, sharing with our industry partners how the government process works, as we learn industry best practices and establish a mutual understanding of each other's needs and requirements. Collaboration with other government agencies, industries, NGOs, academia, and our surrounding communities is a long-standing Army practice that continues to benefit all parties. One of the lessons the OIE learned in our work with the private sector is that there are two requirements for a successful project. Reasonable profit must be made by the private developers who invest in our project, and the projects must serve the Army mission. Only by developing competitive, commercially viable projects can we successfully attract private investors to finance them. And only if those projects support the Army mission will the OEI be trusted to work with the installations that benefit from these projects. This dual requirement minimizes the risk of a return to the excesses of the past. Professor Light states that there is a competition between the needs of the U.S. military and the natural environment. We don't see it that way. The slogan of one Army project management office is, "The world's ultimate weapon runs on water. Everything else runs on fuel." Think about that. Today's Army evaluates energy, water, and land use in every decision, and it not only affects the true life cycle cost of operations and the potential success of our mission, but lack of adequate evaluation of these impacts could place at risk America's most precious resource, its sons and daughters. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Try to be gentle. Thank you. So the perspective that I'm bringing to Sarah's article is from a commercial perspective. The military environmental complex was something that the company I work for, which is Constellation, noticed that there was a shift in the way the government was going about procuring their commodity. To give you a perspective on this, I manage a group that's responsible for about $1.2 billion in annual revenues, of which $800 million is derived from federal, both defense and civilian energy purchases. So when the government comes out, or the DOD specifically comes out and says, we're gonna start buying 3 gigawatts worth of energy on an annual basis from new renewables that we cause to be implemented, that's actually a threat to my business. So the business internalized this threat and said, well, we could do our normal thing and go out to the Hill and start creating arguments that this is perhaps not the best thing, or we can understand it and embrace it. So the company decided to embrace it. And as a result, they stood up an entire business unit for distributed energy to provide behind-the-meter energy generation from renewable sources to serve the DOD and civilians and large industrial and commercial customers alike. And the business is well-funded. Several hundreds of millions of dollars worth of corporate capital is being invested in that infrastructure. as a result of the military environmental complex, which again, when I read Sarah's page or article, I thought the 70 pages might have been a little painful to read through, and actually I couldn't put it down until I was done, just because I live this stuff. So giving you the context of an $800 million shift in the way that I earn earnings per share for the shareholders of the company, noticing that it's a threat, started to build a business around it. That caused us to do things that traditional utilities, or I'm on the unregulated affiliate side, caused us to look into potential investments in research and development projects, initial sort of pilot projects that explore potentially new renewable energy resources in areas that were not considered in the past. And when I went to the company and argued that we feel there's a very good likelihood that we can build a geothermal asset in Maryland at one of the large Army bases here, they said, no, you can't do that. And we said, well, you know, we're gonna invest in understanding what this looks like for our new customers in a different way, and study this under a competitive research and development agreement, which was a legal mechanism in which we were able to engage with the DoD in a collaborative way to understand their needs and provide financing to understand this opportunity. I can tell you that there are no geothermal resources in Maryland. There's 10 kilometers of solid bedrock that you have to go through, and that really doesn't lend well to finding geothermal to power. But, however, the Army did say, well, we're not just restricted to this location, so find another location that is rich in these resources. So one of the pivot statements in the development of this opportunity was a major general came to me and said, this is fine for here, where you're going to displace our expenses associated with the grid utility rates. I'm more interested in, is this technology module? Can we modularize it? And then can we deploy it in the field? And it took me a while to understand where he was thinking, but what I ultimately came up with was, if we can develop a method around intellectual property to discover geothermal resources and come up with a way to modularize this in so much that the government can say, you know what, we're going into this location on the planet, we would really like to order 5, 10, 15 megawatts of geothermal power to offset fuel conflicts and fossil fuel use. And then potentially, after we're done in this area, leave this behind for a nation-building exercise. So the Department of State folks came in when they started to hear this tinge, and the folks that I know over there were very interested in how can, as part of an operation, we create sustainable renewable energy wherever we're going militarily, and maybe not necessarily just devastating everything, but leave an asset behind that then hopefully the folks that we help, which I guess is the goal, the folks we help wind up with having that kind of piece of equipment left at the end of the day. So for me, there was another point that actually I was speaking at the at another event yesterday, and Admiral Lorge was there, and he started to speak about the efforts he was making out on the West Coast. And another panelist on the panel was from San Diego Gas and Electric, and he mentioned that there was a proposal in front of the PUC to potentially charge everybody on the residential side who has a solar panel on their roof a $50 charge, just a flat $50 charge to cover the T&D upkeep for the infrastructure. So when I start hearing the Admiral talk about what he's trying to do, and San Diego Gas and Electric trying to do what they want to do, and 3 gigawatts of renewable power going out there, that's 3 gigawatts worth of energy that the regulated T&Ds are not going to see or a scrape from the KWH rate. Ideally, the majority of it is behind the meter, and they're left out of it. But ultimately, that line still has to stay up and operating and funded. So one of the offshoots of the military environmental complex that may be coming is some sort of a tariff charge. So as more and more of the generation shifts from the traditional generation fleet to an on-site fleet behind the meter, there's going to be some expense associated with that, and you can't necessarily just share it with the bulk of the ratepayers and subsidize what the government's trying to do. So that's my piece, that's my perspective on it. Sarah, I did enjoy.
From the audience, if anyone has one, Lots of questions. If you want to come up to the microphone, and I also, I feel like I would be remiss, I don't usually do this, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that ELI has done some really interesting work on this area on the environmental consequences of war and peace building. And Scott, could I put you on the spot to maybe after this question just say a word about that?
Hi, my name's Sean Dobbs. I'm a law student at the University of Maryland. I've been in environmental law concentration. Prior to going to law school, I was actually demolition contractor, and I worked for the military a lot. I worked at Dover Air Force Base, decommissioning parts of their boilers and parts of their power plant. And a lot of that involved environmental regulation and removal of asbestos, lead paint, etc. Those regulations, as far as the federal government goes, were always adhered to, and then the state as well, which were more stringent. At the same time, I get what Ms. Light is saying about rent seeking, because on October 15th or around there, Lockheed had a press release that talked about compact fusion. And compact fusion is potentially gonna displace wind, everything else, if it actually comes to bear. What I'm saying is that if Lockheed does develop compact fusion, and it's not just that they have a quicker R&D cycle, will rents go up? Whenever you have a high demand for something and all of a sudden the supply shoots up, there is a potential for rent seeking there. There is a potential for a contractor to step in and say, we're going to charge you opportunistic rates. And they developed the energy based off of information that they got from the Navy, from Dr. Broussard. So that's my question, and I just, I'll sit down and take comments.
Just one thing I wanted to say after listening, both in response to the question and listening to your presentations, is that, you know, I said that some of this is about the way the organization as a business operates. So, you know, it complies with asbestos regulations and lead paint and all that because it has to, right? But national policy and leadership does make a difference, and a lot of what both of you were talking about is about the fact that this is a very big business and can use its scale, but it's also about choices being made at a leadership level about what you value. So, you know, the Bush administration also had a big emphasis on energy security, but they thought coal to liquid was a higher priority in hydrogen, and that's where they put DoD money. So their leadership and policy does play a role. And what you're hearing here does reflect a decision, a national policy decision, about how to use the scale of this department. So it does matter, but then a lot of it is just about how it does business. And I think as far as the R&D that's done for the department in response to the department's needs, I think it sometimes it doesn't pan out for DoD's uses, and then it does have a use in the private sector, and that's fine. I think that's a pretty well-worn path. No one has a problem with it. Where it gets controversial with our shareholders on the Hill is where there was never a very clear defense driver, and there's defense money put into it. That's where you're going to see lots of arguments and debates on the Hill, where things get a little contentious. But the fact that sometimes it doesn't pound over and it crosses over is fine, I think.
Just very briefly, I think it's actually very interesting that my article provoked these two very different reactions from our commentators.
Good cop, bad cop.
Exactly. No,
I don't have to defend those programs anymore.
Right. No, absolutely. Right. On the part of Ms. Simpson to suggest that I made too much of the conflict between the military's mission and the environment, and on the part of our former Assistant Secretary of Defense, that there was not enough focus perhaps on how war is consumptive and destructive. Environment. So that suggests that I got it right by making everybody slightly upset with my characterization. No, I'm just teasing. But I guess the story that I want to suggest is that absolutely the military has to comply with the law unless there is a finding by the president or perhaps the Secretary of Defense that there's something in the national security interest. But these exceptions are almost never invoked. The reason for
they're using lead paint in a contingency base in Afghanistan. It's not.
No, I mean at installations and at home. But the point that I want to make is more of a one about what is, and for the lawyers in the room, the idea of the expressive content of the law. The fact that these exceptions exist tells a story, and it's that story that I want to suggest is an important one to listen to.
Scott, could I call on you to just mention the work that we're doing?
Just first, thank you for a wonderful panel. I think this has been one of the strongest all-powers we've had, and just overall, it's been great. And congratulations to Professor Light on hitting the holy grail of a readable law review article. We'll be sure to tell Chief Justice Roberts or Professor or Justice Scalia, whoever made the derogatory comments. But there's also another aspect, I think, to the military-environmental complex, which is the fact that 80% of wars break out over natural resources, and that 50% of the time, those conflicts reignite because the resource management issues weren't taken care of. So at ELI, since 1998, we've had an environmental consequences of war program, which looks at both one thing that Sharon mentioned, which is the environmental consequences of the war itself, but also something John mentioned, which is how do you go back into those societies and rebuild them, and also stop the conflict from igniting in the first place by doing really good natural resource management. So that's, we just published our sixth book in the volume on environmental peace building. So if you Google environmental peace building, you'll find a great program by Carl Brook.
Thank you, and sorry for that advertisement, but really we've been doing that work for a long time. Any other questions or comments, anything from the panel?
I'm a reporter actually for Greenwire, and I'm just curious what the panelists think about the Navy and DOD's use of the Defense Production Act to give awards for the biofuel industry, you know, sort of in this realm that you're talking about, the military environmental complex. Is that an example of it? Is there a reason that it doesn't fit into that sort of idea that you put forth, Professor?
So I don't talk about the biofuel industry in my article, and I would be hesitant to say too much because it's not an area in which I have significant expertise. In general, I think biofuels have been extremely controversial in the area of resources because of concerns when you undertake a full life cycle analysis that biofuel use is actually not necessarily reducing total fossil fuel use because of the energy that's needed to produce the fossil fuel. There's also concern about competing with agricultural produce for the food supply as a cost. So I don't have specific comments about the Navy's recent program, but there's certainly a debate about whether biofuel is something that is a positive for the environment or raises additional environmental concerns, and so I think it would be worth a further study.
I think there's a guy in the audience that wants to answer this question. I'm just kidding. The Department of Defense is very dependent on liquid fuels for its ability to operate. Sarah mentioned that 75% of the department's energy use comes in this operational category, meaning it supports military operations. And that's the part of its energy use that's exempt from the environmental law and policy. That's all liquid fuels, and it's all petroleum fuels, almost all. And for the most part, it's actually jet fuel, because that's a military goal, is to have a single fuel on the battlefield. So the department is, all of its major equipment, its ships, its planes, its vehicles, its even its generators, well, they're not necessarily designed for it, but certainly its ships and planes and vehicles are designed to use liquid fuels, designed to use petroleum fuels. So the department has a long-term interest in making sure there's a reliable, steady supply of liquid fuels. And it's now been a policy for two administrations, both the Obama and Bush administration, to make sure that the department had an interest, had a hand in continuing development of alternative liquid fuels. As I said, the Bush administration was looking at both renewable fuels and coal to liquid fuels, and this administration has looked at renewable fuels. Just about all military equipment now in all services has been certified to use alternative fuel blends. That's a big range, so gas to liquid, coal to liquid, renewable biofuels, anything that's a drop-in, so they can use. And that flexibility, I think, has a good military benefit to it. The Navy's been particularly forward-leaning, and I think this comes back to what I was saying, it becomes a matter of national policy and a decision about national energy security. And again, DoD is a very large consumer,
one of the great things to point out is it accounts for almost 2% of national petroleum use, but that means, you know, 98% of the rest of the country kind of has to come along with change for it to happen. So the Navy's Defense Production Act investment is in that light, is over the long term. It's pretty hard to change a commodity market. But again, what the Secretary of the Navy has said is that the Navy has an interest in making sure that there is a long-term liquid fuel market. And, you know, keep in mind you're talking about an institution that's got a 30-year planning horizon or something like that. So, and I'm not sure exactly what your question was, only that it was generally about the Navy and the DPA and whether or not it fits in with this. The Defense Production Act is a separate tool, and it's a cross-government agencies. All government agencies may use the Defense Production Act, and the Defense Production Act is about the security of industrial supply in the country. Energy is identified in that law as a critical sector in the economy. So it's under that justification that that project was entered into. And I believe there are 3 refineries in the process of being built.
Any other comments? Well, our executive editor is going to offer some very brief closing remarks, but please first join me in thanking this really very interesting conversation.
On behalf of the LPAR student editors, Professors Bregan and Vandenberg, our advisory committee, and the Environmental Law Institute, I'd like to thank all of you for being here today, and thank you to our authors, commenters, and audience members for an engaging series of discussions. I just want to remind you that the audio of the conference will be available on ELI's website, and all of the articles discussed here today will be published with commentary as a special edition of the Environmental Law Reporter. So thank you again, and we hope to see all of you next year.